Now, he is widely regarded as one of the most innovative public policy makers in the world. Sir Geoff Mulgham was a director of policy in 10 Downing Street under Tony Blair. And he's advised many different governments over the years about how to innovate, how to make democracies more resilient, how to forge closer social cohesion. Sir Geoff Mulgham, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you for having me.
You've been in Australia talking to policymakers here. And I know in the past you've often regarded Australia as something of a sort of laboratory of reforms. You've even pilfered a few ideas, I think, ahead of the London Olympics. You had a good look at the Australian Institute of Sport and you thought, maybe that would work in Britain. And it did.
We shamelessly copied it, yeah.
And other stuff as well. I think you looked at the nighttime economy in Melbourne. You thought that was a good way of reviving some of the nighttime economies in Britain.
We used to have a method on any issue. First of all, look at who's doing well in the world and copy them or borrow and adapt. It's a fairly obvious way of doing government, but many don't bother. Many think they are the font of all wisdom.
I mean, a lot of Australian thinking over the years, and it sort of comes from, I think, Donald Horne's great book, The Lucky Country, which claims Australia is very derivative. I mean, he was arguing that Australia just basically borrows ideas from Britain and other countries. But you would perhaps suggest something otherwise, that Britain's been borrowing quite a lot of innovations from here, not least the social media ban that's just coming.
Yeah. I mean, that's been going on for years. You invented the secret ballot in the 80s and 90s. The UK took a lot of economic policies from Paul Keating, Bob Hawke. In the social field, lots on, early year support. You mentioned our sports strategy, which took us from, humiliation at the Olympics to coming third in the medals tables. There are lots and lots of examples. And I think, one of the virtues of being a little bit far away from the rest of the world, one of the virtues of having quite a few states is you can experiment. You can try things out and the rest of the world can see what works and what doesn't.
I once spoke to a very senior British civil servant, and he said that the quickest way to get a British minister interested in an idea is to tell them it came from Australia.
So they could do a study visit in February, probably.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about more serious matters. I had the chance to catch up with you in the week, actually, and you asked what I thought was a really interesting conversational icebreaker. What will democracy look like in 100 years' time? I'm going to frame that in a slightly different way. What's democracy going to look like in 10 years' time, in 20 years' time?
I think we're all incredibly lucky if we're born in democracies in the 21st century, and democracy is the least worst system anyone's ever invented. But most of the democracy we have around us was really invented in the 19th century. The idea you have an election every 3, 4, 5 years, you send a bunch of people to a building in the capital city, there they pass laws, they have parties and programs and manifestos. And that did work well, but I think it increasingly looks like an odd way of expressing the underlying idea of democracy, which is rule by the people. And that's why you can see all over the world lots of experiments to try out just different ways of doing democracy. That might mean citizens' assemblies, which many countries have done. You get a representative sample to look at abortion or end-of-life care or climate change. Many have given people direct power over local budgets. So Paris does this, Iceland does this. So people, including school kids, get the everyday experience of democracy as a participant, not just an observer. And many have platforms where any citizen can propose ideas, comment on ideas. So it's not just parliamentarians or ministers who decide. The whole society takes part in democracy. And to me, that's part of the answer to your question. I hope in 10 years' time, these are much more mainstream and democracy has renewed itself.
But are you worried that democracy really is under threat? We talk a lot about democratic resilience, obviously, in the face of what seems to be a rise in authoritarianism all over the world. I mean, is this a moment of peril for democracy?
I think it is in many countries. There's been a steady decline of confidence in democracy, particularly amongst younger people. It's very age-related. Many under 30s, particularly young men, saying, yeah, we'd quite like an autocrat who would fix things instead of all the mess of democracy. In many countries, stagnant incomes haven't helped. There's a rough link between, stagnation in the economy and people losing confidence in democracy. It's not delivering the goods. And I think the media environment we're in now means that there are many enemies of democracy who really want to undermine it. many of the US billionaire titans, the Musks and Peter Thiels and so on, actually are pretty skeptical of democracy. They think it's an antiquated idea, want us to go back to some kind of autocracy, empire or monarchy. And of course, we have China and Russia spending a lot of money on very directly undermining democracy, causing confusion and chaos, supporting, you know, outlier parties and so on.
Do you think we face a crisis of governance at the moment in Western democracies? I'm struck by how quickly even new governments suffer from the problem of anti-incumbency. You saw that in Britain. Sir Keir Starmer won a landslide parliamentary majority in 2004, but immediately he's hit by anti-incumbency. Even now, overnight in Britain, they've been talking about his future following a by-election loss for the Labour Party there. Anthony Albanese won a landslide. It was a loveless landslide in last year's election, but again, you know, hit by this anti-incumbency. In America, we've had a series of one-term presidencies, Trump 1.0, Joe Biden, Trump 2.0. There will be another president in 4 years' time, presumably. One-term presidencies don't happen often. We seem to be getting a kind of not just an anti-establishment mood at the moment, but an anti-incumbency mood. Governments just can't seem to deliver and become very unpopular very quickly.
That's certainly true in some countries, though others have almost too much incumbency. The number of countries with leaders in their 70s, 80s and 90s who cling on to power is pretty depressing. But in many of the democracies, yes, there is this mood of sullen anger, which means whoever is elected almost immediately becomes disliked. I think that requires different styles of politics. It requires leaders who are better at showing a pathway to the future, a bit more energy, a bit more imagination. Keir Starmer opted for a very low energy kind of politics, saying, hey, I'm just a pragmatic guy who'll fix things. And that doesn't work in our current era. People want a little bit more passion, emotion, drive, and direction. And those leaders who are winning, I mean, Giorgia Meloni in Italy is probably going to be around for quite a while. Viktor Orban in Hungary, even Pedro Sanchez in Spain, he's won, several elections. I think they are signs that if you get your style right, your tone right, and you get the right balance of the short term and the long term, actually you can overcome this sullen anti-incumbency mood.
You said get the style right. Is it impossible now to be a boring leader that you can sort of just have on in the background? You need to be more performative. You need to be more sort of dynamic.
I think the front of house of politics, if you like, and I think you can think of it like a restaurant where you have, you know, your cooks in the kitchen doing the stuff and your front of house, you've got to feed that. You've got to give them stories and ideas and vignettes and battles. I call it the poetry of government. And you have to do that all the time. You can't just stand back and be a quiet technocrat. If you're not explaining what you're doing and why you're doing it, someone else will fill that vacuum.
That's interesting. We've always spoke about campaigning as prose and governance campaigning as poetry and governance as prose. But yeah, you have to keep the poetry going.
I use this formula that to govern you now need poetry, prose and plumbing. So the poetry is the sort of big picture, the messages, the ideas. The prose is your policies. And the plumbing is the kind of boring how you actually govern, which I, as a professor of engineering, particularly love plumbing.
Fantastic.
And in fact, yesterday's by-election in Britain was won by a plumber, a green plumber.
You're listening to ABC Radio National, Saturday Extra with me, Nick Bryant, and I'm talking with Sir Geoff Mulgan, former head of policy at Number 10 in Downing Street under Tony Blair. You lived through the 7/7 terrorist attacks in London in 2005. 52 people were killed in an Islamist attack on the London transport system. Are there lessons that can be learned in Australia after Bondi from Britain's experience after July the 7th?
I think there are. It was 7/7 was a great shock to us. It was one of the trains was my morning train to work, and I knew one of the people who was killed, just as Bondi's clearly been a big shock here. But I think we've got a positive-ish story to tell. In that after 7/7, and obviously we'd had 9/11 only a few years before, there was a big attempt to think, well, how do we stop this happening again? Some of that was about intelligence methods and tracking people and so on, but some of it was also about getting the whole society to take part in watching out for the young people who might be becoming radicalized, and that was included laws requiring schools and universities to watch out for people, quite controversial. Every local area had to have partnerships to, again, ensure that there weren't the seeds of terrorism spreading. A lot of it was about just community relations, working with the faith groups, working with youth centres, getting people just to talk to each other and get on with each other and cultivate friendship. None of it's perfect. But the amazing thing is 21 years later, we haven't had another 7-7. There have been quite a few near miss incidents, but overall, our society hasn't fractured. It hasn't fallen apart. Mass terrorism hasn't become a new normal as we thought it would 20 years ago. And my hope is you'll see the same with Bondi. There's a huge amount of effort around the country, again, to try and ensure there's better ways of spotting the young kid or middle-aged guy who might be about to become a terrorist, but also just helping rebuild mutual trust, mutual confidence, which is what any good society needs.
We talk a lot about social cohesion now. You were talking about the poetry of government. Is that term, you know, do we need a new term to describe the coming together of a society? Do we need a new storyline around that? Social cohesion is kind of dry and jargonistic and academic.
It's a bit jargon. I don't know what the words are. I mean, partly it's just about friendliness, getting on with others, and that we don't want to become, and I guess, I hope Australia doesn't want to become like the US, where there's sort of two camps who just hate each other and don't want their kids mixing, don't want their, you know, can't imagine having a friend or marrying someone from the other political camp. That kind of polarization is really unhealthy. And I think people don't want it. They want to live in a society which gets on with each other, has, you know, a reasonable amount of mutual respect. And we all want a society where there isn't violence, where people don't resort to killing each other, which, of course, has happened again and again on the streets of Europe and North America, not just from Islamists, but also, in fact, the far right probably has killed more people in recent years. And the upsurge of extreme, often male, misogynistic, semi-fascistic terrorism in Britain now is a bigger concern to our security services than Islamism.
And again, how do you combat that?
Well, you've got to try and stop the swamps, as it were, where it grows in social media, in far-right politics. But it's also actually about tracking the individuals who are becoming radicalized, often spending huge amounts of time online watching extreme violence and then losing the sort of conscience which holds most of us back from doing horrible things.
Let's talk about the online world and in particular the rise of artificial intelligence. I confess, I'm freaked out. I worry that it will do to the white-collar sector what automation has done over the past 50 years to the blue-collar sector. I worry about autonomous weaponry. I worry about deep fakes and misinformation, and that it's all going to dumb us all down. Are you more sanguine? Are you more positive?
I've been a bit involved in AI stuff for many years, including running funds and commissioning stuff and developing technologies. And I think the appropriate stance on AI is a mixture of extreme enthusiasm and extreme anxiety. It is an absolutely transformative set of technologies with huge potential to change pretty much everything we do, from our daily lives to schooling to business to transport. But as you say, enormous risks to destroy jobs, to empower evil forces. And we can see that already. And I think all of our societies have been very slow to understand just how powerful a technology it is and how much it needs shaping. And in a way, there's an analogy, I think, with the car. I teach classes on AI and often start with a car in the 1880s. The car transformed everything about our societies, a carbon-based civilization, suburbs, supermarkets, but also gave us car crashes and pollution and climate change and all sorts of wrongs. And the challenge for any society is, how do you get the good stuff you want out of a technology and how do you avoid or minimize the bad stuff? It's not complicated, but you've got to have institutions doing that. And we've been very slow to create institutions to do that. So all the running has been made by business.
So Jeff Morgan, it has been fascinating to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music, and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.